Welcome to the 73rd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as Jeremy Corbyn seizes the leadership of the Labour Party, welcome to the podcast that will always be on the backbenches.
Sniping from the backbenches is indeed what we do best here at Reverse Threat Radio. And in our sights this week, we have county and international cricket in both hemispheres. Andy's going to be talking to us about pitch invasions in cricket and the history, the rich history of them. We are reviewing the new film Death of a Gentleman, and Andy's going to interview the co-director of that film, Sam Collins. So Andy, tell me about what you have been focusing on over the last few weeks since we recorded last in the world of cricket.
It's been a momentous couple of weeks for two 37-year-old county pros who, for kind of different reasons, I've always been quite fond of. So Nottinghamshire wicketkeeper Chris Reid, who I've always thought is one of those brilliant glovesmen in the country. I mean, one of those brilliant glovesmen around. And he became the first wicketkeeper since Jack Russell back in 1997 to reach the landmark of 1,000 first-class dismissals. And then only a few days later, Surrey's captain Gareth Batty took a hat-trick to seal Surrey's promotion to Division 1. Now, when I've been living in South London, I've managed to watch Surrey an awful lot, and Gareth Batty is just this eternal toiler. I mean, absolutely brilliant. You know, actually a very decent spinner and just relentlessly going over after over day after day, and it's wonderful to see him have that success. The interesting thing that links these players is they're both players who had very much nearly man careers with England. They both had their moments, they both played a few one days, a few tests, but never quite made it. But I think we need to remember that we can't be as black and white measuring success or failure in terms of international call-up. I mean, these are guys who've had staggering longevity on the county circuit, and it's great to see them get their moments in the spotlight.
I mean, and you do, I mean, for someone like me, and actually it's something I want to go on and talk about, which is my sort of lack of engagement really nowadays with the county game. But for someone like me, if you say Chris Reid, I remember the times that he was, you know, he was briefly the test keeper for England and captain a few one days. Similarly, Gareth Batty, who I seem to remember the high point of his international career. Does he not rescue someone from the ocean at the World Cup in the West Indies when he was playing for England then, or something? But, you know, anyway, there are these moments in the international scene which kind of stick in your mind as being the highlights, and then you just sort of hear nothing about them for a long, long while, and you suddenly realize, hang on, there they still are, you know, taking catches, taking wickets, making runs,
And you can really underrate, I think, how impressive it is to perform at the top level of county cricket for years and years and years. And I think we'd need to maybe have, you know, respect for those players who've built success in county cricket. Just
37 years old. I mean, that's, I know. You know, ancient in
and
the,
both still,
in
both
the
still,
scheme of things
both
when it
still
comes
going
to
strong. Now, you on the subject of being ancient.
Yeah, very good, very good. Someone who's not going so strong anymore, or at least is still going strong, but has retired anyway. I'll shut up and try and not salvage that segue anymore. Brad Haddin. Now, Haddin's had an interesting summer. Of course, he stepped down, as it were, from the ashes in order to be with his very sick daughter. He was then left out of the team. Peter Neville was preferred, and this week Brad Haddin announced that he was formally retiring from all forms of international cricket. And I've always been struck by Brad Haddin, particularly throughout this summer and this whole series of events that could have just turned really, not necessarily acrimonious, but could have left a real sort of sour taste in the mouth. The fact that Cricket Australia essentially asked him to choose between his family and his international career.
Yep.
The fact that he didn't, when he went home from that one game and it became quite clear that he wasn't going to play any more Ashes. The fact that he didn't just say at that point, oh, you know, bugger this for a laugh, I'm just going to retire in the middle of the series. The fact that he sticks with it. And then also the fact that when it became clear that Peter Neville was going to take on the wicketkeeping berth for the rest of the series, the fact that Haddin just supported him 110%. He didn't sort of think, oh well, actually if Neville gets his foot in the door, Haddin was more likely not to get back in. He just sort of thought, well, what's best for the team, I'm going to do that. And it's just nice. I mean, we talk a lot about how players often fail to retire with dignity at the right time under nice circumstances, and Brad Haddin really is a model of how if you do everything for the like reasons and genuinely have a sort of humility towards your place in playing the game, these things can actually end quite well, and I think that's something that we should applaud.
The Haddon dropping did seem to cause real havoc in the Australia camp, but Michael Clarke, for example, seemed really upset by it. He's a very close confidant of his. But I think you're entirely right that Haddon was throughout the ultimate team man. He didn't come out and complain. He backed Peter Neville to the hilt. And I think I'll admit, as an England cricket fan, I've never found Brad Haddon easy to like. He sort of has a lot of on the pitch has a lot of. I think the worst characteristics of Australian cricketers go. He's very in your face, very sort of confrontational. Not the classiest of cricketers. After Australia won the World Cup, he was giving drunken interviews on the radio, slagging off New Zealand and things. He's not. But he. One thing you could certainly say about him, he's a true team man.
And of course, he wasn't the only Australian, to just continue our theme of slightly dodgy segues. He wasn't the only Australian institution to be retired within the last few weeks, was he?
That's very good, actually. Yes, the end is nigh for the Wacker, or at least almost nigh. It's been announced that the legendary ground will hold no major internationals there from t 2018, and these games are going to move to the brand new Perth Stadium. And there are a lot of very sensible reasons for this change. The Perth Stadium is sort of much more sort of purpose built. It can get a lot more fans in, but it's sad to see the end of a venue with such history. The interesting thing is Australia, and you would note, if you've spent the time out that. Australian cricket grounds are generally a lot bigger than ours in the UK, and they can hold an awful lot more fans. And the Wacker was a rare example of a test ground with a much, it was much tighter and had a much, only held 20,000, so had a much more intense atmosphere. And it also had a pitch as legendary as any in test cricket. I mean, the mere mention of the Wacker evokes pictures of bouncers flying at heads. And cricket badly needs these venues with their own personality, that, visiting teams will fear to play. Because I think sadly, there are fewer and fewer of these venues that are quite as evocative. So it will be sad to see it go.
Yeah, it's a sense of moving away from grounds towards stadia, I think is the kind of predominant one, that thing of just how many people can we fit into a ground, and how many corporate boxes can we have on the side of the ground. And one of the interesting things with this announcement about the Wacker has been the amount of coverage that's been written about the history of the Wacker as a ground. And actually, there's been some really, really interesting things, and you sort of see that, as you say, the identity that a cricket venue and the kind of personality as well that a cricket venue sort of builds up is really, really important. And you see it with Lords. Lords definitely has a personality as a cricket ground, and I don't think we should discount that.
Now, back in England, the county season is drawing to a close, and this seems to have taken you by surprise.
Well, it does. I mean, I'm perennially confused by seasons, just because obviously I have a lot of contact with people in the UK who are obviously on the other side of the seasonal dial than I am in my little life out here in Australia. But it's rare that I went onto the Guardian website, and I was just browsing through, looking at the news actually, and then I suddenly saw a piece about Yorkshire have won the county championship at Lords, and I suddenly thought to myself, hang on, no, there hasn't been a county championship season. And partly it was because in my mind it's spring, because we're just coming into spring here in Australia. But partly as well, I suddenly realised I have just completely, basically failed to follow the county championship this year. And it's actually being out of a sort of media landscape that just includes it as a matter of course. If I just turn on local radio in Sydney in the morning, which is what I listen to, obviously they never talk about county cricket. And that's actually, I suddenly realised, quite a sad thing actually, that I don't have that immersion in the game. As much as anything, it just means I need to stop being lazy and just actually make sure that I'm checking the scorecards a bit more.
I think the funny thing is that often it's one of cricket and particularly county cricket's real pleasures actually, is that you can often follow from a distance. There's often been this point made that you can often have empty county grounds sometimes in the middle of the week, but there'll be thousands of people around the country fervently checking the scorecards. But I think when you're not, as you say, when you're not in that country, it's not in the background, is it? There's no reason for it. Is the Australian domestic game, does it have, where would it compare in terms of media profile to the English county game here? I mean, does it get well covered in the local press there?
It does. I think the thing to remember about the Australian is that you have to think of the states as kind of in countries, in the same way that so in New South Wales you get the Sydney Morning Herald, which is the kind of major local paper, and that covers mostly in, predominantly it covers the game in New South Wales, and then similarly you go to Western Australia and whatever the paper is out there basically covered. And the Australian is the only paper that covers the entire country. So actually, it's you don't get that much of a picture of the game across the whole country. From the archives, and for this episode, Andy's going to take us through something that we don't see much of nowadays: pitch invasions in cricket.
What's surprising is that looking back at the history of cricket, pitch invasions for a long time were actually quite an accepted end-of-game ritual. You'd have, especially at the end of big games, test matches, cup finals, crowds would actually regularly rush onto the pitch and then they'd watch the presentations on the pavilion balcony. It's actually quite a nice way of getting a bit of camaraderie going between players and crowd, getting the crowd involved. What really surprised me actually, and I found this out talking to a work colleague, is that this was actually common practice at Lord's, which we often see as being that little bit snootier, not willing to kind of maybe allow the crowd that level of interaction. And this work colleague was sharing with me his fond memories of going onto the pitch to celebrate after a Benson and Hedges Cup final in the 80s.
Now, pitch invasion is an interesting phrase, actually, because invasion automatically seems like quite an aggressive word. And actually, obviously, our kind of viewing experience of cricket has really bridged the gap when pitch invasions sort of stopped happening and when they started becoming very taboo. But what's actually very interesting about what you've just said is that when they were so sort of normal, you wouldn't actually, and so commonplace, they wouldn't have been presumably sort of aggressive at all. When you go onto YouTube and watch the films, they're always the ones where you have, massive crowds and it all looks very ferocious. But presumably, most of the time, it was quite kind of gentle. It was just the done thing to run onto the pitch and then just watch the presentation.
Do you know what? I think it was one of those lovely compromises where, in a way, the fans weren't really supposed to do it, but there was kind of a tacit understanding that if they waited at the end of the game and they were politely run, and it was fine and it was accepted. And as I said, it did lead to these sort of rather lovely scenes of the presentations happening in the pavilion and the fans all below being able to get close to the players. But I think you're quite right. It was sedate, and it was after, it was very clearly after the game. But some invasions have always been much more raucous in the history of the game. You go back to 1999 and the West Indies Australia ODI in Guyana. Now, the Windies fans wrongly thought the game was finished when there was still an over to go. And you can go on YouTube, watch the video, and it is quite extraordinary the speed at which the pitch fills up. I mean, it goes from, within almost 30 seconds, there's hundreds and hundreds of West Indians on the pitch. And you have this rather wonderful farce of the police having to chase the fans who've run away with the stumps to allow the game to continue. Very similar farce. We go back to 1983 World Cup semi between England and India. India fans again mistakenly thinking their team had already won the game when there was still one run short. Again, the Indian fans have to be encouraged to leave the pitch. And Bob Willis, who was the England captain at the time, is just sort of standing there with his team about to go out of the World Cup, having to patiently wait to sort of deliver the final ball. So, to some extent, there's quite an enjoy. You watch these videos, there's an element that's just quite funny about them. There's quite an entertaining element of farce. But they did have more serious consequences than that. So, if you go back to the Guyana ODI, the pitch was invaded again on the final ball. And it appeared that West Indies had won the game by a single run, because Australia needed three off the final ball. They didn't manage to get them. But the match referee later ruled that given the invasion, it was unclear whether Australia could have completed that final run. So the game was declared a tie. So
So
you actually.
presumably, what the ball didn't come into the keeper, and then the keeper knocked the bails off. It sort of, the pitch invasion happened while the ball was sort of still in play in a way, even though it was obvious the
It
last
was
run couldn't be
very
made.
much, it was very much still in play. And actually, I think if you watch the video now, it's quite clear that Australia couldn't have made that final run. But you have to admire Steve Waugh's determination. He's actually going for this final run, pushing through a crowd of fans.
Oh, really?
So he is totally fixated on trying. Interestingly, the match referee, the verdict was only it was decided an hour after the game had finished. And neither captain disputed the match referee's verdict. So the West Indies, even though they, I think, actually had won the game, work. I think they accepted their culpability with the fans coming on the pitch and were willing to accept the tie. So you have a situation there where actually the result of a game has been changed by the pitch invasion. But there's also this element of danger. Captain Steve Waugh actually suffered whiplash during that incident, and he later said that he had feared a Monica Seles-style stabbing incident. So this is the American tennis player who, get during a game in Germany, a fan ran onto the pitch and stabbed him. It was a famous incident. And it's quite, he makes a fair point. I mean, I think there wasn't a level of malice to the invasion, but the sheer number of people, and people are barging him, trying to take his bat off
Well, it's a
him.
sense of a stampede, really, isn't it, actually?
It's exactly that. So without malice, there's still danger in that many people running on. And there's a similar story about this potential danger. Fifth test of the 84 England West Indies series. We're at the Oval, and the West Indies fans invade the pitch to celebrate the famous Blackwash victory. And it's the unfortunate Jonathan Agnew who's on test debut. And in the rush onto the pitch, his bat, helmet, gloves are all stolen. And he would later describe this experience as terrifying, which, I mean, you can imagine it would be, having a horde of probably heavily inebriated, heavily excited fans literally stripping you of your kit.
And this isn't something that's unique to cricket either, is it? And this isn't something that I've sort of researched in any way, but you see a lot of historic footage of football matches and rugby matches as well, where it is absolutely just the done thing for these hordes of people to run onto the pitch. And exactly because of that kind of stampede effect, you do sort of end up wondering how it's going to end. I remember there was one, I can't remember what year it was, but one year when England won the Five Nations in rugby. And there's this footage of, I think it's Will Carling being carried off in a kind of sort of crowd surfing motion almost. People lift him up and then pass him from one person's shoulders to the next. And you do suddenly sort of think, well, actually, that must be a fairly, to be so much at the mercy of the mob must be a fairly terrifying thing.
I think a lot of sports find it a really, really difficult balance because there is something, for example, for a really big success for a sports team, there is actually something rather lovely about that exuberance of fans being able to get on the pitch, share them. And I actually, my football team QPR had a major victory a couple of years ago, and the pitch was invaded, and but it was actually rather lovely. Fans were just out on the pitch taking pictures with the players. It was all very state. But I guess what we've covered is the fact there's a very narrow dividing line between these sort of sedate invasions and these kind of raucous invasions where players are in trouble and it can get out of hand. And in cricket history, the turning point came at an ODI between Pakistan and England at Edgbaston in 2001. And a steward who was desperately attempting to keep protesters off the square was punched and kicked by Pakistani fans, left with broken ribs, damaged spleen. And this was a turning point. There was an acceptance that actually, for too long, these invasions had been tolerated. And it was also clear that the stewards were being put in an impossible position. I mean, were they supposed to do their jobs? Were they just supposed to stand by? And as a result of that, grounds enforced much, much stronger regulations. And if you go to any cricket ground now, there's very clear signage on this. You face
Fines, announcements over the tannoy, it's all
Well,
sorts. It's
it's
pretty.
actually it's a the research I've done on this, it's a four-figure fine pretty much anywhere. It's long-term banning
Really?
from the ground. I mean, it is really, really severe. And I think in a way it does reflect how the sport has evolved. I think it's impossible to imagine the modern professional cricketer putting up with what Agnew put up with, putting up with Steve Waugh. For better or for worse, these are professional sportsmen who are used to being well looked after, treated like professional sportsmen. And again, perhaps rather sadly, they're used to having fans kept at a distance that they can manage. One slight aside is watching the invasions of the West Indies fans, particularly at Guyana, then at the Oval, the footage there. It was quite a sad reminder that nowadays you'd struggle to get together a big enough and passionate enough West Indian crowd at a game like that. And I thought it was another rather, as an aside, it was another rather sad indictment of the way West Indies cricket has fallen.
It does. It sort of speaks of that sense of climax that you get at the end of games. That scene of a massive crowd running onto a pitch kind of is very much associated with healthy Test cricket, because you don't get it if it's been a ball draw over 5 days, or
It's
a
exactly
sort of
that.
a nonsense victory.
You don't get it if nobody cares. this is a key point. And I can understand that some fans undoubtedly miss the drama of these invasions, and they miss the chance to have that moment with the players. There were some moments where you could run on and you could slap your favourite player on the back and say, well done, mate. But the end of the invasions have actually allowed teams the chance to create their own cricketing theatre. And I think perhaps the best example of that is that wonderful flint-off moment with Brett Lee at Edgbaston back in 2005, where he goes over, incredibly well-known photo, goes over to console Lee. And that was seen as a defining moment in that series, defining sort of spirit of cricket moment. And actually, had there been a pitch invasion underway, they'd have just been scampering for cover. So it allows the players their moment, I think, to celebrate and bring the game to the end in the way they want
To the review. And this episode, we're going to be talking about a film. And this is a film which, unless you've been hiding under a rock in the cricket world for the last few weeks, you will definitely have heard of. It's called Death of a Gentleman. It was co-directed by Sam Collins and Jarrod Kimber. And the first thing for me to say is, in the interest of full disclosure, I haven't actually watched it. It hasn't been released in Australia yet, so big black mark against it on that front. Andy has watched it. He's got some strong opinions on it. He's going to be interviewing Sam Collins, the co-director, later in the podcast. Andy, I suppose the big question is, there's been so much in the press around this film, so many opinions, it's provoked so much debate. For you, what was the kind of core question at the heart of Death of a Gentleman?
The interesting thing is the core question changes, and Sam Collins and Jarrod Kimber are extremely upfront about this in the film. They set off to make a film about the death of Test cricket and could Test cricket survive in a world of T20? And very quickly, as they made the point, they realised that that question was part of a much bigger one to do with cricket administration as a whole. And it really comes down very nicely to a line that Gideon Hay, the incomparable Gideon Hay, uses at one point in the film, where he says, "Does cricket make money to exist, or does cricket exist to make money?" And his argument, and this is kind of the debate at the centre of the film, is that it was previously the former and it's now become much, much more blurred.
And what's the sort of style of the film, in a sense? Because do you get the sense? I mean, Sam Collins, I have to say, I haven't really come across all that much in the past. Jarrod Kimber, I've come across a lot more through his work, particularly with Crick Info. They're both fairly opinionated people. Are they sort of trying to prove a point with this film? Are they sort of setting out to prove something, or is it more sort of reportage than that almost?
So Sam is very clear that they don't see themselves as investigative journalists. That's not their background. They're cricket journalists and cricket fans, and they approach this in that way. And one of the things I think the film's been unfairly criticised for, so for example, Ed Smith actually took both of them to town on TMS on this
Oh, I
point,
heard
where
that.
he, it's very interesting, where he basically said, "You make all these accusations, but you don't land your points." And I think it is missing the point, because I think they're both very honest. They say, "We're cricket fans, we're trying to find." And what they do brilliantly is that they capture the culture of impunity at the top of the game. And I think you made the suggestion, it's kind of Louis Theroux-esque. He doesn't, it's not a kind of precise an essay. It's not outlining a precise series of arguments. It's outlining a culture, a sense, a feeling amongst a group of people, and they do that brilliantly. They visit the shady Dubai HQ of the ICC, where you can't even find the bloody building. No one will tell you where it is, and you get there, and it's surrounded by security. There's no disclosure of any. It's impossible to get any access. There's these fascinating comments of their cameraman, who has dealt in the past with Zimbabwean dictators and politicians, and says that his experience with these cricket administrators is just as bad as any of those. And finally, there are these extraordinary interviews with Giles Clarke and Srinivasan, where both of them, you wonder, for all the money that's being spent in cricket administration, certainly none of it's being spent on communications or comms lessons for either of those, because they come across as relentlessly obnoxious, self-interested.
I was just going to say I'm fascinated by these interviews, and having not, I mean, I've seen sort of clips and sort of sound bites from the film, but I haven't seen the whole thing. And by the way, please do release it in Australia first. I'm desperate to see it in Australia soon. But the what I was wondering is about the sort of how the film is put together. I mean, is it predominantly a sequence of interviews that sort of speak for themselves, or is there a kind of sort of presenter, a sort of host throughout the thing that's kind of commenting on things as it goes along? How does that work? Do we have Jared and Sam sort of talking to camera about things, saying, "Oh, this is what you should think about what you've just heard," or how does that side?
It's a good
work?
Question. So I guess mainly, I suppose Sam is the narrator, but it's kind of a combination of two things. It's there are lots of interviews sort of cut in to the film, but it really traces their journey of making the film. And I think this is actually one of the most entertaining things about it, is that I think if you had been watching a very, and this is no slight at all on the pair, because they're very honest, you know, this is their first documentary, they've not done this before. If you'd been watching a professional documentary maker, I think the whole thing would have been slicker, but maybe in a less interesting way, because what you actually see them doing is fighting the battles of making a film about a very difficult topic. They go on lots of trips and meet lots of people that end up not getting them anywhere at all, but that's kind of part of the fun. It's sort of part of the chase, and you get very caught up in watching these two very charismatic and very determined cricket lovers desperately trying to find out what's gone wrong with the game they love. And there's something really compelling about that hunt. You know, it takes them to Dubai, takes them to Sri Lanka, takes them everywhere.
And you talk about the kind of the compelling hunt, and is it a because often things like this can turn out being quite dry. Is it watchable?
It's a really interesting point whether non-cricket lovers would find it watchable. I think on balance, there is enough human interest, and there is not that it would be. I know some of the reviews have said, "Oh, unless you're a Test cricket fan, don't go anywhere near this." One way that they really keep the human interest angle going, there is a side, almost a side story to the film about Ed Cowan, who the two co-directors, Jared and Sam, know very well, and they're able to track Ed, and he allows them, who seems, by the way, the loveliest of professional sportsmen, is so humble and so thoughtful about the game, and he allows them full access to film him through his, basically through his Australia Test career, actually. And in a way, you would think, well, why does that link into the film? But what it does that's so important is, amongst all the doom and gloom of the film, you're reminded that actually this is what we're fighting for. We're fighting for players like Ed Cowan living their dream, succeeding in Test cricket, having their, you know, their moment in sport. And it actually works really well as a counterpoint to a lot of the gloom and doom of the cricket administration.
And you do hope, I mean, you know, sort of, the likelihood is, well, the reality is that films don't, or, you know, single articles, films, whatever it is, don't change the world. But it seems as though, and again, having not seen the film, but having seen a lot of reaction to the film, that the result of it will be that it has sort of heightened awareness of these issues, and it's heightened actually the ability for there to be a discourse around these issues. And that's happened even in, you know, as I keep on saying, it hasn't been released in Australia, but that's happened even here within
Absolutely stunning is the level of attention the film's getting for what's supposed to be a niche documentary. I mean, I went to the saw it at the Gate Theatre in Notting Hill, and I turned up, and there was a huge crowd of people outside, and I thought, God, has there been an accident or something? And I sort of turn up and ask, and they said, "Oh no, we're here for Death of a Gentleman." You know, people are queuing in the street to watch this cricket documentary. They're selling out all over the country. Sam is very, very clear that the film is supposed to be the start rather than the end. So it's the start of this movement, Change Cricket. They've already started. There's a petition underway. There was a protest at the Oval in the final test. I think he is very realistic. He's not idealistic about how he sees this being a very, very hard and a very long-term project. But I think what was very interesting in the Q&A after the film showing I saw at the gate was that there are a lot of cricket fans in there who knew their stuff, but clearly were shocked to see it all put together, if you see what I mean. They knew things were wrong with the game, but they had never seen it so coherently put in one place. And there are a lot of very angry people there. What's obvious, anyone who's been involved in any sort of form of social change, it's clear that a group of angry people doesn't instantly move to change. But I think it will be very interesting to see whether the film is able to get a momentum going and put some significant people under pressure.
So that is Death of a Gentleman. Comes highly recommended by Andy, who's seen it, and by me, who hasn't, whatever that means. You can find out dates of screenings on their websites, I believe, and stay tuned because next up, Andy talks to the co-director, Sam Collins.
To the interview, and this episode I had the chance to speak to Sam Collins, co-director of Death of a Gentleman. Hi Sam, thanks very much for coming on the show. Before we get to the bigger cricket issues that the film Death of a Gentleman raises, I felt watching the film that it was also something of a personal odyssey for you and Jared. It was 4 years in the making, and it seemed to demand a lot of you, both in terms of, traveling across the world, dealing with some quite unhelpful interviewees, having to dig quite hard to find the right people. I wondered what was the hardest part of making the film from your perspective?
I think just finishing it. I think the thing is, this has actually 4 years, as you say. It really has. It's become my life, in particular, over the last few years. I mean, Jared's been working for Crick Info over that period, but the about 2 years in, I sort of had to give up everything else and keep going. And obviously, you've got to raise a hell of a lot of money to make the film. You've actually got to make sure that the money you've looked people in the eye and taken their money off them to try and, claiming you're going to try and do something which is going to do some good. And then there's the realization that you've actually got to do that. You've got to see it through. And to do that, actually, you have to make a film which stands up as a film,
Did you
not
ever
just
come
a.
close? Were there any moments where you were very, very close to saying, this just can't be finished, this can't be done, I'm sort of at the end of my tether with this, or where there was
Yeah,
always.
absolutely. Because we didn't have a film for half of it. We didn't have a, when you're, you get. Oh, I spend a lot of time talking about the actual, the journalistic side and the cricketing side. But the most important thing on this has actually been the film side. In that you have to create a narrative structure. You have to give people a satisfying ending. You have to. There has to be development of your characters. All these things. When you're, we've created basically a sort of Trojan horse. We've taken an important issue through to people through an entertainment product without sounding too much like a cricket administrator. And so that in that sense, you've got to make sure that your film is up to scratch. Because if your film doesn't work, then people are, the audience are, for some reason, however, whatever you tell them, they're not going to feel satisfied. And so that's been the most difficult thing, obviously trying to keep it afloat and keep the money and basically persuade my wife that this is worth me working on for another year, etc. But actually, coming up, condensing sort of 800 hours of footage or however much we ended up with, 80 interviewees, 90 interviewees, and all the extra footage we got, and condensing that into a narrative that people will feel satisfied by. That's, I suppose, that's the most satisfying thing about it, is feeling like, well, getting to the stage where you feel now. Like I know that, you know, we constantly have people picking holes in whatever, but I don't care. I'm satisfied that we've done what we set out.
You must be
to.
Delighted as with the response. I mean, I had a wonderful time seeing the film on Thursday night, and I had the chance to see it with someone who was a really great cricket fan and someone who wasn't really into their cricket, and both of them enjoyed it. And I was thrilled to see that the gate was full, the gate cinema was full for the super screening. I wondered, you've now had the chance to do quite a few Q&A sessions in the film, quite a lot opportunities to meet people who've seen the film. Is there anything that people are picking up on in the film that you wouldn't necessarily have expected them to? Is there any parts of the response to the film that have taken you by surprise?
Not really, actually. I think it's really gratifying when people pick up on the stuff you want them to pick up on. You know, we always wanted to make it a human story. You know, really, it's a story about people trying to stand up for something they care about. Yeah, I suppose I'm surprised sometimes by what people don't get. You know, and that when people say, for example, oh, we haven't come up with the silver bullet to actually get rid of Srinivasan or Giles Clarke. You know, as though we are actual, you know, investigative journalists rather than you know, that's not what we've tried to do. We have deliberately set out not to play. We're not accusing them of actual blatter style, or behind the scenes FIFA corruption, Jack Warner. What we're doing is we're framing a moral scandal.
One of the most striking things I thought was Giles Clarke, without any effort, I thought, sorry, not without any effort, but without any kind of subterfuge on you and Jared's part, becomes the villain of the film very quickly. And the way he acts constantly on camera, he's so brazen with you, he's so rude. And I thought what was fascinating was you two were painstakingly polite, I felt, with him. And yet he felt constant need to be confrontational. And what kind of ended up fascinating me about Giles Clarke was what do you think motivates him? I mean, he doesn't seem to have a particular passion for the game. He's not, at least to any intents, but he doesn't seem to be making a huge amount of money or any money. You know, he's not paid for. Did you get a sense talking to him? Why is he involved in this? What is he getting out of this?
Well, we deliberately try and leave this for you guys to decide. Yes. You know, the audience. You know, we credit our audience with having a brain. You know, and for example, being able to see that Lalit Modi is an ambiguous figure.
Yes.
But Giles, I think with rich and powerful men, they crave power. You know, they crave meaning something. You know, but everybody's got to have a reason to get up in the morning. And Giles Clarke, I think in cricket, someone like Giles has found a world where he is able just to walk in and run it. You know, and he walked in and managed to work his way up from running Somerset to running England, and now he can see an opportunity to run the world. And this is an opportunity to run. You know, I think there's no doubt that Giles Clarke wants to be chairman of the ICC after entering Srinivasan. I think there's no doubt that Giles Clarke would not turn down a knighthood for his services to cricket. I think there's, you know, these things are, there are many things that drive people when they get into these positions. And I think, you know, as I've said, you know, I mean, my beef with Giles Clarke is nothing to do with what he's like personally, I think. But I think that, I mean, we all know people like Giles. How he comes across on film is very much how he came across to us in real life. We haven't edited that to make him look bad in any way. The problem, to me, the problem with Giles Clarke is that he's a particular type of person who doesn't know what he doesn't know, and that attitude has led to him making some calamitous mistakes as an administrator. And that's my problem with him, is that he is, in my opinion, a terrible administrator. He hasn't balanced the need to grow the game with the need to bring as much money into it as possible. Participation in this country is down since he's been in charge. Viewership's down. He's stood in the way of the growth of the game globally and of independent administration. And I don't think that you could do much worse. That's a terrible legacy for the game, my opinion.
There's an interesting point in the film, actually, both with him and Srinivasan, where you sort of wonder as a viewer, are you dealing with malice or incompetence? And that there does seem to be a bit of both. Now, aside from those interviews, the film seemed to give you the most wonderful opportunity to go to speak to the most brilliant array of cricket players, administrators, writers. And you made the point, actually, in your Q&A at the gate, that actually some wonderful interview footage had to get left on the cutting room floor just because of your time constraints. I wondered which of the interviews for you were some of the most memorable.
Do you want some of the ones that we didn't use?
Yeah, that would be really interesting, actually.
I mean, we had some lovely ones. Mohammed Amir,
Ah.
we spent a long time setting that interview up, and we got some wonderful stuff from Amir, sort of talking with his eyes closed and about what it would mean to come back to international cricket. And again, quite clearly, like Modi, he was using us to position himself for his return. It's
Yes,
quite
yeah.
cynical, but you when you watch it through that prism, it's really interesting. Dickie Bird gave some lovely sort of color. Who else? There was some Neil Maxwell. I actually found it was a fascinating interview. He snuck into the film with one bite, but he's an administrator who's sort of constantly looking to push the boundaries of the game to America. He was a very, very interesting person to speak to. So many more who didn't make it. I suppose, I mean, Gideon Lucas obviously Gideon's obviously absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I
Cause,
must admit, for me, he was just everything he said seemed to strike sort of it really struck a key note. Every time he spoke, he seemed to really reinforce the key messages of the film as well.
absolutely. And D David Becker, Tim May,
Yeah.
Tim May, anyway, yeah.
So actually, I wondered very, very much picking up on that. There was this lovely Gideon Hay line about, does cricket exist to make money that then supports cricket, or is it making money? Is that the ultimate aim? And I just wondered, if, say, we were really pessimistic and say it's not going to be possible in the near future to break this triumvirate at the top of the game, who are, as you make a very compelling case, are holding the game's revenues hostage, not expanding the game. Do you think there's an opportunity that greed will actually eventually drive them to do the things you want them to do? So, for example, India will have a look and say, actually, there's no way we're going to expand this pot without, for example, going into the Olympics, without trying to spread the game to more countries. Or is that an over-optimistic narrative?
I think you're crediting them with too much perspective. I mean, I don't think, if you look at India and China, have a pretty fractious relationship. Do we think that India are going to be bending over backwards to hand over, to hand over control of cricket? When I say control of cricket, to get countries that are bigger than them interested in cricket. I'm not sure that that's really. I'm not sure that that's the case. I think that all those three countries, I think England and Australia are obviously quite resigned to the dominance of India, but I think all three of them are quite comfortable with the positions that they hold in cricket's world order. I'm not really sure that they have much ambition to cede their power to further to China or America, for
Yeah,
example.
because I must admit that Olympics, the example of the Olympics, does seem an absolutely fascinating one. It just seemed like such a huge opportunity, to the TV audiences you'd get, and the point you made in the film that actually for a country like China, suddenly the funding would come in, and to turn that down does feel incredibly short-sighted. I wondered, you're very clear about the fact that the original purpose of the film, this idea of the struggles of Test cricket, became this much bigger question. But I wonder if, just back on the issue of the struggles of Test cricket, did making the film make you, I guess, more or less optimistic about the future of Test cricket? And did it give you any ideas? I mean, you show some, I think, very sort of sad footage actually of Test cricket really struggling to get crowds in Sri Lanka, for example. And I wondered, have you got any thoughts on, is that a reversible decline? Can we get those countries who have really moved towards 2020, can we get crowds back in those countries watching Test cricket?
Yeah, I think we definitely can. I think the thing is, what you need is, the Olympic, all this stuff is the same. It's under the same topic. Cricket, we know that one thing, which is Test cricket, is a game which has proven its ability to appeal over a long, long period of time. Now, to give it the best chance, one of the issues you've got in the subcontinent is that, that for example, in India, what percentage of India's population are under 30? Something like 60 to 70%. So when you have a situation where 70% of your of 70% of 70% of your market are under 30, then that shows you one of the difficulties, given that Test cricket will traditionally appeal to an older audience. But I think the thing is that we know the game has nothing really to prove to anyone. What it just needs is to be given the opportunity to compete on as equal a footing as possible. And to that end, you know, can we find a way, can we find ways to give it context? Can we find ways to incentivize it? So, you know, can you find ways to make sure that the best players are playing it the whole time?
Well, I thought you made a wonderful point in that in the film when you spoke to Chris Gayle, because Chris Gayle's been so often held up as this villain in Test cricket, so that, you know, dumping it at first. But I mean, the point he made about basically he wants to not just play Test cricket, but he wants to play meaningful Test cricket, I thought was a really strong one. You thought actually it's hard to blame him for turning down, you know, poxy two test series that we invite the West Indies to play at the start of April or whatever. You know, actually,
Exactly.
you did really well. I think it actually, it made it very easy for the viewer to empathise with him in that, in his
Well,
position.
the players are pawns in this situation. Yes, I think there's definitely an argument that the players are actually the only people who could perhaps hold the administrators to account, because without the players there is no game. But it's quite a difficult thing to ask 20 something blokes who are, you know, who are trying to earn as much money as they possibly can in the short term, and we shouldn't, you know, be critical of them for that, because that's what we would all do in similar situations. You know, they will just do what they're told, essentially, or they will go where the opportunities are. And when Test cricket is made so vastly unattractive for them, what is the incentive for Chris Gayle to play two tests in Bangladesh?
So, a final question, Sam, that really fascinated me watching the film and kept coming to mind. You came to this as someone who loved the game. You came to this as a cricket journalist. Has seeing what you've seen and setting up the movement Change Cricket, has it in any way made it harder for you just to sit down and watch a good day's Test cricket? Or is that simple pleasure still very much there for you? Or has everything you've seen made it difficult to appreciate the game in that way?
Well, I think inevitably you were, you know, you inevitably you're always thinking about what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, look, cricket, that's cricket's when there's a great session of cricket on, or when there's a great moment where which it just sort of sets in, like the weather at sea or something like that, doesn't it? And that's the power of it, is most of cricket happens and you know you're always sort of thinking slightly about something else, but then for an hour or something it'll capture you, and it has that ability to make you unable to think of anything else.